From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Peter O'Dowd. It's Here and Now. This morning, House Speaker Nancy Pelosi announced a historic new chapter in the impeachment inquiry against President Trump.
Sadly, but with confidence and humility, with allegiance to our founders and a heart full of love for America, today I am asking our chairman to proceed with articles of impeachment.
This marks the next step in a deeply partisan battle to remove the president from office. Democrats say he abused his power in his dealings with Ukraine, but the president said today that Republicans have never been more united. NPR political reporter Tim Mack joins us now. And Tim, help us understand the history that Nancy Pelosi made this morning.
Right. Well, I think that she realized that it was a momentous occasion. And in some ways, we've been on a trajectory to this moment for some months. I mean, if you had been following the speaker's statements and her press conferences over the last year, she did come at this reluctantly. She was not initially interested in going down the path of an impeachment inquiry and now the drafting of articles of impeachment. But the facts changed, and as she has said repeatedly, the times have found us. And now she has taken this new step, which is the formal announcement of the drafting of these articles.
And Tim, what about the tone of the day? We just heard Nancy Pelosi reference the founding fathers. She talked about their fear of foreign influence and election interference. Her mood was somber. But then later in the morning, she was visibly angry. She said, "Don't mess with me," when a reporter asked if she hated the president. You just got to wonder if this next step in impeachment is going to change the tone and the tenor in Washington.
We're still very early in this impeachment process, relatively speaking. The articles of impeachment have not been drafted. They need to be considered in committee. Then the full House would presumably need to vote on these articles in order for it to move forward and get sent to the Senate. And then there will be a trial. We don't know how lengthy that will be. There are a lot of very tense times ahead. And House Speaker Nancy Pelosi took offense when a reporter asked her if she hated the president. She said that she's a Catholic, and as a Catholic, she doesn't hate anyone. Mm. And so that is an interesting sign of how heated this debate and this topic is going to be in coming months.
Well, there still is a lot that we do not know, as you mentioned. One, for instance, is whether the articles will be narrowly focused on the issue of Ukraine or potentially include other high crimes and misdemeanors, perhaps drawing in something from Robert Mueller's investigation. How have Democrats been debating that behind closed doors?
Well, there's a split among Democratic lawmakers. Should the impeachment articles be broader in scope, like you said, mention part of the Russia investigation and the findings of the Mueller report, which suggested there were possible instances of obstruction of justice? Or should it just be narrowly focused, narrowly tailored to just include the Ukraine issue and this alleged scheme that the president had to leverage U.S. foreign policy for personal and political gain? Now, this isn't something that has yet been settled, but it will have to be settled as they draft these articles in coming weeks.
Let's hear from Republicans and their reaction to Nancy Pelosi's announcement this morning. Here's House Minority Leader Kevin McCarthy.
This is the day the nation is weaker because they surely cannot put their animosity or their fear of losing an election in the future in front of all the other things that the American people want.
McCarthy referring there to Democrats. He also accused the party of moving too fast without any proof of wrongdoing. Tim, are Republicans as unified as President Trump said they were on Twitter today?
Well, right now we're not seeing any House Republicans, at least, indicate that they would support articles of impeachment. There was some hope as Democrats approached this process. Democrats thought that they could probably or possibly get a few moderate Republicans to join them for this, for at least, you know, approving the rules of the impeachment inquiry. That turned out not to be the case. There hasn't been any indication amongst moderate Republicans that they are willing to join and approve articles of impeachment against the president based on the facts right now.
And just quickly, after these articles are drawn up, what's the timeline? Because I see the Senate has basically cleared its calendar in January.
That's right. It's very uncertain. Actually, senators received a calendar of the year, all 12 months, with the exception of January, which was totally blank. I saw a senator in an elevator just staring at that blank month on this page of 12 months. It's just that January is not even listed as a month. There's just a blank spot where that is. It's going to be a very uncertain process as we go towards a trial. We don't know how long it is. It's going to take some time for those issues to be resolved. And the first step is the House Judiciary Committee will be meeting on Monday to hear from lawyers from the relevant committees about the facts of the investigation.
NPR's Tim Mak. Thanks so much.
Thanks a lot.
Republican Congressman Devin Nunes of California, the ranking member on the House Intelligence Committee, has been defending himself this week after call records show he had contact with Lev Parnas. Parnas is the Ukraine-born businessman arrested in October on campaign finance violations. He also allegedly worked with Rudy Giuliani to dig up dirt on Joe Biden, a scheme Parnas's lawyer says Nunes helped with, too. Here's what Nunes had to say to Fox News' Sean Hannity on Tuesday.
Did you ever talk to this guy, Les Parnas, or whoever his name is?
You know, it's possible, but I haven't gone through all my phone records. I don't really recall that name. You know, I remember the name now because he's been indicted.
Elise Vibeck has been looking at Nunes' possible involvement. She's with The Washington Post, investigative political reporter there. Elise, welcome.
Thank you very much for having me.
Well, and let's start with these phone logs. Tell us what they tell us exactly about Nunes' contact with Parnas.
Well, we're looking at an episode in the month of April. We see at least three contacts in a single day between Nunes and Parnas. And this was a couple of days after Nunes traded some communications with Rudy Giuliani. And I think the month of April is important because that's the same month that Marie Yovanovitch, the former ambassador to Ukraine, was recalled. It's a key period during this Ukraine saga. And so I think we're all wondering exactly what the content of those phone calls was.
CNN has also reported that Parnas's lawyer, Joseph Bondi, said that Nunes met with the ex-Ukrainian prosecutor general Viktor Shokin in Vienna last year. Nunes has sued CNN over that story. But what do we know about that alleged meeting?
So we have not confirmed that. We heard the same thing from Parnas's lawyer. But as you said, Nunes himself has thoroughly denied it. He says that instead of being in Vienna meeting with Shokin, he was actually in Benghazi, Libya, and also in Malta. So congressional travel records do show that he was in Europe around that time. What we are unsure of is whether that was the Malta trip that Nunes has pointed to or whether he was indeed in Vienna.
What are the implications if he was communicating with Parnas?
I think it raises some really interesting questions about conflicts of interest for Mr. Nunes, who we should note has been a longtime ally and booster of the president. He was part of his transition team following the 2016 election. So I think for Mr. Nunes, this is very tricky territory. And there have been several Democrats who have given rise to the possibility of perhaps an ethics investigation. The most senior Democrat in the House to have mentioned something along these lines would have been Steny Hoyer, the House Majority Leader, who said this week that he wants some of these questions answered, and it's possible that the House committees will play a role in that.
And if the reports about Nunes's communication with Parnas are true, what would that tell you about the reach of the administration's efforts in Ukraine, the Trump administration?
Well, it just shows, if it's true, how coordinated and sort of thoroughgoing this effort was. But we should clarify, we at The Washington Post have not reported that this is true and that it happened. But we do know that from these call records released by the report by the House Intelligence Committee this week, that there were so many contacts between Giuliani, perhaps Trump, Parnas, John Solomon, the former columnist for The Hill. So and these came at very crucial moments in the Ukraine saga. So I think that if it's true that Nunes was involved, which he's left open the possibility that he spoke with Lev Parnas, as you aired on that clip. So I think that if he was involved, there are some pretty serious questions facing him about conflicts of interest.
Well, and Lev Parnas's lawyer has said that Nunes should have recused himself from the impeachment inquiry. What do you think Parnas's motivations here are in talking about the potential involvement of Devin Nunes?
Well, Parnas has really been mounting a public campaign to be allowed to testify as part of the impeachment inquiry. One of his lawyers said that with appropriate protections, Parnas would fill in the blanks in terms of what he talked about with Devin Nunes. So we're a little unclear on whether Parnas will be allowed to testify. It's possible that he will not be because, of course, he is being prosecuted federally under campaign finance charges, and the Hill tends to yield to the Justice Department in cases like this. But I think that if he were to testify, it's possible we would find out some very interesting information from him.
And could Nunes face some kind of repercussion or punishment if it turns out he was involved and was communicating with Parnas?
It's possible. And I think those Democratic lawmakers have hinted at those consequences. We should also note that he has been investigated before. The Ethics Committee cleared him in December of 2017 after he was accused of giving classified information to the White House. So we have sort of seen this story play out before, but in that case, it's important to note that he was cleared.
That is Elise Vibeck, Washington Post investigative political reporter. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
The new film, The Aeronauts, tells a little-known chapter in the history of flight, the quest to go higher than anyone in history in a balloon. Oscar-winning actor Eddie Redmayne stars as scientist James Glacier, who attempted to set the altitude record back in 1862. Redmayne won the Oscar in 2015 for playing Stephen Hawking in The Theory of Everything. Felicity Jones co-starred in that film. She co-stars in this film as well, playing balloon pilot Amelia Wren. In this scene, the two prepare for takeoff.
Are you ready?
Yes, I just need to retake my ground readings. Do one final check of the equipment.
Well, my equipment was all prepared in advance. Now, don't touch this rope, Mr. Glacier, as it will let out the gas.
I don't know how a balloon works.
The Aeronauts opens in theaters tomorrow, and joining me now is Eddie Redmayne. Welcome to Here and Now.
Hi, how are you?
Doing well. Thank you so much for joining us. And we should say, by the way, that Felicity Jones's character was not a real person. She's based on several female aeronauts. But your character, James Glacier, was a real person. Tell us about him.
Well, that's absolutely true. So the film is, there's a wonderful book called Falling Upwards, which is a kind of history of air ballooning. And our film is sort of inspired by some of the best bits. It's almost sort of greatest hits of some of those moments. Mm-hmm. And James Glacier was a 19th century sort of early meteorologist at a time when the idea of predicting the weather was sort of deemed absurd. And he ended up, I mean, the real figure had clergymen and doctors up and down the country taking measurements on what the weather was doing around Britain. And he was the first person to sort of collate those pieces of information and try to find patterns in it. But he went up in a balloon and was desperate to try and... Everyone at the time, science was being used and adventure were being used. People climbing Everest, going mm-hmm. to the poles, and people going up in balloons in competitions to sort of see who go the highest. But no one was necessarily using it to find out information about the unknown. And so he was that's what he was attempting to do.
Nobody believed that you could even ever figure out how to predict the weather.
Exactly. It was deemed crazy. And he was sort of looked down on, and meteorology was seen as sort of hocus pocus. And for me, one of the things I found riveting is it was a moment in history which I knew nothing about.
Right.
And it actually never occurred to me that there was a time when people, of course, didn't have any idea what was coming. So that was one of the elements I found intriguing.
Well, the other thing about it is that, you know, we think about the history of flight and we think about airplanes and we think about you know, the Wright brothers or whoever. But I guess I never really spent a lot of time thinking about the fact that before there were airplanes, we had to figure out how to get balloons up in the air, and that was a whole part of history all on its own.
You know, there was a book for me by Julian Barnes, he's one of my favorite authors, called The Levels of Life. And the first chapter of that basically talked about early balloon flight and what it must have been like to be the first people to see the world from the sky. Mm-hmm. And it's a beautiful meditation, that book. And I read this maybe eight years ago, and I found it very impactful. And so when this script arrived, it had all that wonder. It had all the idea of looking up and the pioneering sense of the unknown that I found kind of intriguing, mixed with a kind of old-fashioned adventure. So it was that sort of combination. But one of the things that was interesting from a filmmaking point of view is we're now, of course, so numb to seeing the world from the sky because people go on airplanes.
Right.
And It was how do you make an audience look at that anew and afresh? And going up in an air balloon is a very specific thing, particularly gas balloons, which is what these guys flew in because it's so silent.
Right.
But you're completely at the whim of the elements.
Almost all of this film takes place in a balloon. What was it like to film? How high up did you go? Or how often were you actually in a balloon versus in something that made it look like you were in a balloon?
Well, so the important differentiation is these were gas balloons. Mm-hmm. So they don't really exist in the UK anymore. That is to say, a helium or hydrogen balloon taped in by a net, basically, and attached to a basket. And the way you go up is by letting it go. And the way you come down is by pulling a rope that lets the gas out. And the other thing you can use is you can throw off ballast to make you go higher. So really, they built a balloon for our film. They recreated the Mammoth, the famous balloon from this flight. But in our country, there aren't many people who fly gas balloons anymore. So they built one, and we went up on our first few days of filming. Felicity and I were in costume, and they shot us from helicopters and drones. And Felicity Jones, who's in the film with me, does astonishing things in this movie as far as risk is concerned. And she was sitting up in the hoop of the balloon, despite the fact that we were thousands of feet in the air. But it was incredibly peaceful and very beautiful while these drones and the helicopters were shooting. And when they left, they sort of disappeared off once they got the footage they needed, and we just had to land. But of course, the technology hasn't changed for 150 years, and so our landing was particularly catastrophic. Oh, and Felicity very nearly killed herself. It was a scary few days of filming in the balloons, but with one really quite intense crash. And from then on, we moved into studios where this basket was suspended around blue curtains. And although, interestingly, they refrigerated the studios so that you could feel the cold so and the breath.
Think you were at 30,000 feet.
Exactly.
Let's listen to a scene from the movie, actually, which, of course, shows how dangerous ballooning can be. You're flying into a storm. Here it is.
We need to batten down. Please put on your wet weather clothing. There are no prizes for obstinacy. James, if you won't listen to me, listen to that.
Wait, not one of my readings suggested a storm.
Well, that's what it is. And we're inside a cumulus, which is precisely where we shouldn't be.
Don't worry.
We should say, by the way, that this is not the first time that you've been in a film with Felicity Jones, who plays your wife in The Theory of Everything.
Exactly, yeah. So one of the great appeals for me with this film when I was sent the script was the idea of getting to play opposite Felicity again, who I just adore as an actor and as a friend. And that weird thing that actors have, that often you become very close to people when you're working, and you push each other and get to learn each other's process, and then you go off and start a new thing. And actually to come back and work with someone picking up where you left off was an intriguing idea, and we loved it. We were also stuck in a tiny basket for months on end, so it was important we got on.
Well, there's something else that I noticed about the two films, which is that in The Theory of Everything, you were playing Stephen Hawking, someone with ALS, for much of the movie. You had to act without talking. And in this film, you're up so high in the sky that you're so cold, you're frozen, and you also have to do kind of the same thing.
That's exactly, the character gets hypoxia at a moment in which Felicity's character has to kind of save their lives. But it was interesting. One of the things I love about what I do is that you get to go and research it, and you're given the freedom to go and play around it. So the hypoxia element of the film, we actually went, the director and I, to this place where they put pilots who are training into these tanks and change the air pressure to recreate what it's like at 35,000 feet. And what's interesting is that you feel, rather than feeling dreamy, and you actually get incredibly confident, that they make you do these tests of sort of 1+1, and you're sitting there, and they make you do it every 3 seconds, and they go 1+1. You go, obviously 1+1 is 4, stupid. You get sort of more and more drunk and confident, weirdly. So that was interesting, and bringing all those sort of things that you learn and trying to find ways into the piece with it. So, but no, you're right. There were definitely similarities. I mean, there was a moment when I've spent a lot of the past 6 years in tweed or in period drama costumes. I was sort of looking to do an American contemporary piece, and then this came along, play an English period drama playing a scientist, there was something in it that wasn't necessarily what I've been looking for, but it was something that I found completely unique, so wanted to pursue.
One thing that is different about this film for you is that you are now an Academy Award winning best actor. How has that changed your life and your career?
Gosh, it's an interesting question. I think that the reality is that it gives you more choice, and that's something, you know, for many years when you're starting out as an actor, you audition for things and you get what you're given and you're lucky enough to be employed, and then something like The Theory of Everything happens, and suddenly you're sent more things and given more of a sense of choice. But it's interesting because when you're starting out as a kid, you get sent a script and it's like, Cate Blanchett is attached to this with this director and this director, and that comes with a sense of expectation, or you go, oh, those are brilliant actors and that's a wonderful thing, whereas suddenly you're being given the script before there's a director attached or early on in the process, and so it's interesting. Suddenly it's your thoughts and ideas and taste rather than that of someone else.
And we should also say that there are probably some listeners who are hearing us talk to you right now and thinking, I don't care about this new movie. I want to know what it's like to be Newt Scamander, Fantastic Beasts. This is the latest Harry Potter franchise. Do you get stopped in the street by especially young people who want you to perform spells?
You do. Particularly, there's a particular age when magic is still completely real. In which I always feel like I let people down by not being able to sort of whip out a Niffler from my pocket or a sort of extraordinary magical creature of some description. And it's an amazing thing. It's a really wonderful thing because you make films in these vacuums. And whereas with theatre, you see an audience every night, you can feel whether they're coming on the ride with you or enjoying it. But what's weird with films is you make them at this particular moment in time and then they come out a year later and even though you sort of know they're in cinemas or they're streaming, you don't necessarily know that people are... It feels odd that the people are actually going out and watching it. So when people come and react with excitement and joy, and particularly something that's aimed at or with kids in mind, it's really special.
Well, I have to say that I have wanted to go in a hot air balloon my entire life, and I want to even more now after watching this film, although I would stop at maybe 15,000 feet and then just come right back down.
I think that would be a wise idea for all of us.
That is Eddie Redmayne, Academy Award-winning actor who stars in the new film The Aeronauts. Eddie Redmayne, thank you so much for joining us.
Thanks for having us.
And that film opens tomorrow.
Hi, it's Robin Young, thanking you for listening to the Here and Now podcast and inviting you to contribute to support it at donate.npr.org/now. For all the reasons that you listen, Here and Now helps you make sense of the world, and when you donate to your NPR station, you're supporting the journalism that brings context and perspective to the news and conversations with people making a difference in the arts, music, and culture. So please, make a donation to your NPR station today, and that investment will come right back to your ears. Just go to donate.npr.org/now. We're building NPR and its member stations thanks to you. Now, let's get back to the news.
The San Francisco 49ers have suspended commentator Tim Ryan for comments he made about Baltimore Ravens quarterback Lamar Jackson after the Ravens beat the 49ers last Sunday. Here's Ryan on KNBR Radio talking about why Jackson is so good at hiding the ball when running fake handoffs to other players.
His dark skin color with a dark football with a dark uniform. You could not see that thing.
Lamar Jackson is black. Ryan, who is white and also played in the NFL, has apologized. He says he regrets his choice of words. Mike Pesca is Here and Now's sports analyst. He hosts the daily podcast, The Gist, at Slate.com. And Mike, we've spoken with you about Lamar Jackson this season because he's very good. He's a potential MVP. What are your thoughts on this latest story?
It's the very definition of ignorance, but tinged with something more. And I don't know that it was the intent of Tim Ryan, but you have to. Well, let's first of all just flat out say it's not true. The coloration of a brown football against the Ravens, you know, dark jersey and whatever Lamar Jackson's skin color is said to be, it is not why he's so good at fake handoffs. He's so good at fake handoffs because, A, that's a skill set unto itself.
Right.
And B, he's this ultimate threat weapon where he can run the ball and throw the ball. And since a defender has to honor all those things, you can't always assume he's going to do one instead of the other. So that's just the fact. But the other thing I would say, the tinge is, you know, the position of the black quarterback is the most fraught in the NFL. And even Lamar Jackson, showing that he was this amazing player in college who kind of anyone with eyes would say, oh my God, let's get this guy in the NFL and see what he could do. You know, he was told to play wide receiver. He was top scouts were saying, oh, I don't think he could be a quarterback. And you'd have to think that this is only because he was black, and people who are scouts and, you know, people who are very expert in this field who are also more cognizant of the racial history will flat out tell you that. So you add it all together and this, you know, the suspension seems warranted. I'm not going to say anything about what Tim Ryan intended or what's in his heart, but it's really an ignorant and damaging thing to say.
Well, either way, regardless, he will not be in the broadcast booth against the Saints this weekend. So let's talk about something else. Basketball. Did you see LeBron James travel last night in Utah?
Yeah, but you know who didn't?
The refs.
Yeah.
Listen, let me talk about this real quick. The video is just unreal. LeBron James is casually dribbling the ball down the court, and then he just stops dribbling and takes 3.5 steps up the court. You don't have to know much about basketball to know that that is a traveling violation. The ref did not call it, and here's LeBron James after the game.
Yeah, it was the worst thing I ever, probably one of the worst things I've ever done in my career. I didn't even realize I did it until halftime, to be honest. One of my coaches showed me. I didn't even realize I did it. I think at the same time,
one of the worst things, Mike, I ever did in my career.
Yeah, and this is the guy who took his talents to South Beach. I don't know. I can't actually tell if he was kidding, if he was essentially saying, all right, guys, you know, I literally walked on a non-competitive play, a non-competitive part of the play, or if he was saying, oh my God, that really was egregious and I'll call myself out on it. What listeners should know is that he was just casually walking the ball up the court. He wasn't really being guarded at this point, and there was no reason he started to walk except perhaps he had the mental lapse.
Yeah.
And then the referees did, and the embarrassing thing is there has always been the accusation, and stats bear this out.
Gotta be quick.
Great pros get the call, and maybe this was LeBron benefiting from the ref swallowing their
Mike Pesca, thanks so much.
Defense Secretary Mark Esper says the U.S. has finished pulling troops out of northeastern Syria. About 600 U.S. troops remain in the rest of the country. Esper says those troops are focused on counterterrorism operations against what's left of the Islamic State. Meanwhile, Russia has moved in to fill the vacuum that the U.S. created when it left the area. NPR reports Russian flags are flying in Syrian Kurdish towns. The Syrian Kurds are longtime U.S. allies, but they have turned to Russia for military support since President Trump's withdrawal order in October. Joining us now is Peter Galbraith, former U.S. ambassador, longtime specialist on the Kurds, and just back from Syria. Welcome.
Good to be with you.
Well, and first, what do you make of the news being reported by NPR that Russian flags are flying in the Kurdish territory of Syria?
Well, it's not surprising because the Russians have come in along the border. They have military police there. They're protected by the Syrian Kurdish military forces. But overall, the scene in northeast Syria is perhaps a bit reminiscent of the bar scene from Star Wars. There are Russian troops, there are Turkish troops, there are regime forces, and of course, there are the Kurdish forces.
You just returned from the region yourself. What were you doing there, and what would you say things are like on the ground at this point?
Well, I've been part of a process talking to the Syrian Kurds about negotiations with Damascus, as well as mediating between the Syrian Kurds and the Iraqi Kurds. But also I was involved in an effort to extract some children from the ISIS camps. Got out a young American three-year-old, so with some success.
Well, tell me more about that.
Well, so there are about 10,000 foreign women and children. About 7,000 of them are children in three camps. All of the women chose to go to Syria, and most of them remain radical. But if the children remain in the camps, first, it's a terrible place for children, but also they're going to grow up and be radicalized. They'll be the next generation of jihadis. So the idea is simply to try to get as many of them out as possible. In this case, it was an American orphan and a German woman and her children, a woman who had long since renounced the Islamic State. And all of them are back in Germany. The American is back in the United States.
You also met with the leader of the Syrian Kurds, right, Mazlum Kobani?
I did.
And how does he feel about the U.S. pullout and the future of the Kurds in Syria?
Well, it's no surprise that he's deeply disappointed. The United States had been the ally of the Syrian Kurds. It had provided the Air Force in the successful battle against the Islamic State. It had provided weapons. And Trump administration officials had repeatedly told them that the U.S. would stay until Iran was out of Syria. And since Iran has no intention of leaving Syria, the expectation was that the United States would be there for the long run. But, of course, the trouble these days for foreigners who have to deal with American diplomats is that they often don't speak for the president of the United States, who impulsively does other things. So, you know, there was great disappointment, an effort to figure out what do we do now. If they had known this was coming, they would have been in a much stronger position to negotiate a deal with Damascus. But, you know, that seems to be the only plausible course they have. The Syrian Kurds never fought against the Syrian government. Really, there were two separate wars in Syria, one of the Kurds against the Islamic State, and then and that was on the east and north of the Euphrates, and on the west and south, it was the government against a variety of opposition groups. So there wasn't a direct conflict. So some deal is possible, but, you know, the question is how much autonomy could the Kurds have? What would be the role of their security forces? And, you know, this clearly undermined their negotiating position.
The war in Syria over the last many years now has led to hundreds of thousands of deaths, millions of people displaced. Is the situation for civilians at this point as desperate as ever, or has it gotten better, do you think?
I think in some places it's gotten better. Where the war is over, there is an improvement. People are not being killed. It is not a happy outcome for millions of Syrians who had hoped for the overthrow of the Assad government. But even among Syrian rebels, having seen how things developed, many of them regret that the whole revolution started because of the enormous destruction and the enormous loss of life. Where things have gotten worse, unfortunately, is for our own allies, the Syrian Kurds, who had created a stable area, a place with a very interesting social experiment. For example, in all government positions, a strict gender equality between men and women so that their various legislative bodies are 50-50. They're co-prime ministers for each of their cantons, co-leaders, a male and female co-leaders for the entire area. And there, that experiment is in danger. A couple hundred thousand people have been displaced from their home. Hundreds have been killed. But really, the continuing problem is that what is Turkey going to do next? What is the United States going to do next? At the moment, Turkish forces are in, 100-kilometer area between Tel Abyad and Ras al Ain. But the main population centers are to the east and west of that, Amudeh, where your NPR reporter was, Qamishli, the largest city. Will Turkey move into those areas? And if so, the human toll will be many multiples of what it is now, or if it moves west to Kobani, again, you're going to have much greater suffering.
And is Turkey taking responsibility for the thousands of ISIS prisoners who had been held by the Kurds in that part of Syria?
No. The prisoners are still under the control of the Syrian Kurds, and there many of them, particularly the fighters, are outside of the 32-kilometer zone that Turkey is saying it wants to intervene. But the other issue is that Turkey is the country that permitted the foreign fighters to enter Syria. There are about 40,000 foreign fighters, according to some estimates, who had joined the Islamic State. Every single one of them got to Syria through Turkey. And it's impossible to believe that Turkey didn't know what was going on. And we've seen the quality of the Turkish intelligence service in the Khashoggi affair, where, you know, they were able to tell the world, you know, minute by minute about what happened to Jamal Khashoggi, mm-hmm. the Saudi journalist who was dismembered in the Saudi consulate in Istanbul. You know, you can't quite believe they didn't know those 40,000 people were going to Syria to join the Islamic State. So it's hard to believe that Turkey is serious about trying to contain or detain the very fighters that it permitted to enter Syria.
I finally want to ask you, Peter Galbraith, do you think that the Kurds, who have been U.S. allies so many times, will ever trust the U.S. again?
It's certainly difficult. It's hard to imagine a people who have been whose trust has been more abused than the Kurds. And, you know, the 1970s, Kissinger encouraged the Iraqi Kurds to stage an uprising against Saddam and then acquiesced in its betrayal. In 91, the first President Bush called for an uprising. The Kurds rose up, and then Bush sat on his hands as Iraq attacked. And in 2017, the Trump administration permitted a Shia militia headed up by a guy named Abu Mahdi Muhandis, who had been convicted of blowing up the U.S. embassy in Kuwait, to use American Abrams tanks against the Kurds in the city of Kirkuk. And now in Syria, you have what the Kurds see, and I think correctly, as a betrayal. And yet they continue to deal with the United States, perhaps because they don't have many other choices. But certainly the level of trust is much diminished. And finally, you know, what's happened to the Kurds is a sign of what happens to people who don't have their own country. Mm-hmm. In the world today, having your own state is a huge form of protection. And of course, the Kurds are the most numerous people on the planet who don't have their own country.
That is Peter Galbraith, former U.S. ambassador, longtime specialist on the Kurds, just back from a trip to Syria. Thank you so much for joining us.
Well, very good talking to you.
The UN's Climate Summit of World Leaders continues today in Madrid, Spain. Protesters from around the world are also rolling into town ahead of a strike tomorrow led by Swedish teen activist Greta Thunberg. Earlier this morning, those protesters said they were concerned about carbon markets.
The sky is not for sale.
Policymakers at the summit are working on plans for a global carbon market under the Paris Agreement after they failed to reach a solution last year. The idea is to find a way for polluting countries to buy credits from other countries that have lowered their emissions. But activists say carbon markets lack transparency and accountability, and a better solution, they say, would be for countries to cut emissions at the source. The climate summit continues through next week, and we will keep an eye on that. But first, let's take a look at a new trend here in the U.S. Restaurants without diners. They're also known as ghost kitchens, and they're the new delivery-only operations that cater to smartphone apps like DoorDash and Uber Eats. NPR's tech correspondent Shannon Bond tells us how these mysterious restaurants are feeding the appetite for eating at home.
In a bright red building in Redwood City, south of San Francisco, cooks are plunging baskets of French fries into hot oil and wrapping falafel in pita bread. What's missing? Waiters and customers. Every dish is placed in a to-go box or bag. Who picks up the food? Delivery drivers. They sit in a waiting room ready for the name on their order to be called.
I have orders for Charles, Mike T, Costa, Francisco,
Each bag of food sports a red sticker with the logo of DoorDash, America's biggest restaurant delivery app. DoorDash manages everything here. The food is made by 5 restaurants that rent the kitchens. Fuad Hannon oversees the kitchen venture for DoorDash.
Rather than having to build a physical brick-and-mortar store, we do that on their behalf, and then they move into our DoorDash kitchen, and then overnight they're live on the DoorDash platform.
Of course, many restaurants have always offered takeout and delivery. But now, thanks to apps like DoorDash, Grubhub, and Postmates, there's such huge demand for eating at home The kitchens like this are sprouting up all over, dedicated to delivery.
Your customer is just like at their living room, watching Netflix.
Min Park is an investor in Rooster and Rice. It's a chicken chain with 6 locations in the Bay Area and a DoorDash tenant. People in the U.S. spent almost $27 billion last year on food delivery orders placed by app, website, or text message, according to the NPD Group, a market researcher. Well, that's a small slice of the $800 billion restaurant industry. Online delivery is growing fast, and money is pouring into delivery-only kitchens. They go by a variety of names: commissary kitchens, ghost kitchens, virtual kitchens, dark kitchens. Uber co-founder Travis Kalanick has reportedly raised hundreds of millions of dollars from Saudi Arabia for his new business, Cloud Kitchens. Min Park says this DoorDash kitchen lets Rooster and Rice test new neighborhoods without committing a lot of money to a new restaurant, hiring waiters and other staff.
In San Francisco, it could easily cost about $750 to $1 million for like a medium-sized space. And, you know, the commissary kitchen model gets us to a similar revenue demand level at a fraction of the cost. So
these delivery apps are transforming some established restaurants. They're even creating separate menus just for smartphone apps. Uber Eats is one of the fastest growing parts of Uber, and it knows exactly what food its customers are searching for, and it knows when those searches don't turn up results. So Uber tells restaurants to use their existing kitchens to offer a whole new menu, under a different name and only available through the app. There are more than 4,000 of these virtual restaurants on Uber Eats. Janelle Salanov, head of Uber Eats in North America, explains how it works.
You know, a bakery that actually now also runs a burger restaurant only on the platform through that same kitchen because that neighborhood didn't have enough burger restaurants.
DoorDash suggests where restaurants should expand delivery and menu items based on the millions of orders it receives. All of these suggestions help the restaurants get a sales boost, the app companies say. And some restaurants, like Rooster and Rice, say those additional sales make up for the costs associated with delivery. But the restaurant industry has never been easy, and the apps take a big cut from those delivery orders. Ken Ray knows how that works. He opened a la carte delivery in Miami in 2017. He set up a ghost kitchen and began creating menus for the apps.
We started off originally with just a couple brands. I had one brand that was called Witch Chicken Pizza Concept, that was called Mott Street Pizza that I created, Fresco Mexicano. And then over a 10-month period, we essentially, you know, developed 15 different restaurant brands.
But without name recognition, it was hard to find customers. And the 30% commission most apps charged made it impossible for his business to cover its expenses.
You know, for restaurants, it's tough, you know, to give away that 30%. So, you know, a lot of these guys, you know, the Ubers, the Postmates, the Grubhub, you know, they've essentially built an amazing business, but they've built it off the back of the restaurateur.
Ray closed a la carte delivery in July. He still believes that people have a big appetite for delivery, but it needs to be palatable for restaurants, too. Shannon Bond, NPR News, San Francisco.
I have an appetite right now. Here and Now is a production of NPR and WBUR in association with the BBC World Service. I'm Peter O'Dowd.
I'm Jeremy Hobson. This is Here and Now.